This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 1, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 1, How the Great Wind Came to Beacon House. Part 1. A wind sprang high in the west, like a wave of unreasonable happiness, and tore eastward across England, trailing with it the frosty scent of forests and the cold intoxication of the sea. In a million holes and corners it refreshed a man like a flagon, and astonished him like a blow. In the inmost chambers of intricate and embowered houses it woke like a domestic explosion, littering the floor with some professor's papers till they seemed as precious as fugitive, or blowing out the candle by which a boy reads Treasure Island, and wrapping him in a roaring dark. But everywhere it bore drama into undramatic lives, and carried the trump of crisis across the world. Many a harassed mother in a mean backyard had looked at five dwarfish shirts on the clothesline as at some small sick tragedy. It was as if she had hanged her five children. The wind came, and they were full and kicking as if five fat imps had sprung into them, and far down in her oppressed subconscious she half remembered those coarse comedies of her father's when the elves still dwelt in the homes of men. Many an unnoticed girl in a dank walled garden had tossed herself into the hammock with the same intolerant gesture with which she might have tossed herself into the Thames. And that wind rent the waving wall of woods and lifted the hammock like a balloon, and showed her shapes of quaint clouds far beyond, and pictures of bright villages far below, as if she rode heaven in a fairy boat. Many a dusty clerk or cleric, plodding a telescopic road of poplars, thought for the hundredth time that they were like the plumes of a hearse when this invisible energy caught and swung and clashed them round his head like a wreath of salutation of seraphic wings. There was in it something more than inspired and authoritative, even than the old wind of the proverb. This was the good wind that blows nobody harm. The flying blast struck London just where it scales the northern heights, terrace above terrace as precipitous as Edinburgh. It was round about this place that some poet, probably drunk, looked up astonished at all those streets gone skywards, and thinking vaguely of glaciers and roped mountaineers, gave it the name of Swiss Cottage, which it has never been able to shake off. At some stage of those heights, a terrace of tall grey houses, mostly empty and almost as desolate as the Grampians, curved round at the western end, so that at the last building a boarding establishment called Beacon House offered abruptly to the sunset its high, narrow, and towering termination, like the prow of some deserted ship. The ship, however, was not wholly deserted. The proprietor of the boarding house, a Mrs. Duke, was one of those helpless persons against whom fate wars in vain. She smiled vaguely both before and after all her calamities. She was too soft to be hurt. But by the aid, or rather under the orders, of a strenuous niece, she always kept the remains of a clientele, mostly of young but listless folks, and there were actually five inmates standing disconsolately about the garden when the great gale broke at the base of the terminal tower behind them, as the sea bursts against the base of an outstanding cliff. All day that hill of houses over London had been domed and sealed up with cold cloud. Yet three men and two girls had at last found even the grey and chilly garden more tolerable than the black and cheerless interior. When the wind came, it split the sky and shouldered the cloudland left and right, unbarring great clear furnaces of evening gold. The burst of light released and burst of air blowing seemed to come almost simultaneously, and the wind especially caught everything in a throttling violence. The bright short grass lay all one way like a brushed hair. Every shrub in the garden tugged at its roots like a dog at the collar, and strained every leaping leaf after the hunting and exterminating element. Now and again a twig would snap and fly like a bolt from an arbalist. The three men stood stiffly and aslant against the wind, as if leaning against a wall. The two ladies disappeared into the house. Rather, to speak truly, they were blown into the house. Their two frocks, blue and white, looked like two big broken flowers driving and drifting upon the gale. Nor is such a poetic fancy inappropriate, for there was something oddly romantic about this inrush of air and light after a long, leaden, and unlifting day. Grass and garden trees seemed glittering with something at once good and unnatural, like a fire from fairyland. It seemed like a strange sunrise, the wrong end of the day. The girl in white dived in quickly enough, for she wore a white hat of the proportions of a parachute, which might have wafted her away into the colored clouds of the evening. She was their one splash of splendor and irradiated wealth in that impecunious place, staying there temporarily with a friend, an heiress in a small way, by name Rosamund Hunt, brown-eyed, round-faced, but resolute and rather boisterous. On top of her wealth, she was good-humored and rather good-looking, but she had not married, perhaps because there was always a crowd of men around her. She was not fast, though some might have called her vulgar, but she gave irresolute youths an impression of being at once popular and inaccessible. A man felt as if he had fallen in love with Cleopatra, or as if he were asking for a great actress at the stage door. Indeed, some theatrical spangles seemed to cling about Miss Hunt. She played the guitar and the mandolin. She always wanted charades, and with that great rending of the sky by sun and storm, she felt a girlish melodrama swell within her. To the crashing orchestration of the air, the clouds rose like the curtain of some long-expected pantomime. Nor, oddly, was the girl in blue entirely unimpressed by this apocalypse in a private garden, though she was one of the most prosaic and practical creatures alive. She was, indeed, no other than the strenuous niece whose strength alone upheld that mansion of decay. But as the gale swung and swelled the blue and white skirts till they took on the monstrous contours of Victorian crinolines, a sunken memory stirred in her that was almost romance, a memory of a dusty volume of Punch in an aunt's house in infancy, pictures of crinoline hoops and croquet hoops and some pretty story, of which perhaps they were a part. This half-perceptible fragrance in her thoughts faded almost instantly, and Diana Duke entered the house even more promptly than her companion. Tall, slim, aquiline, and dark, she seemed made for such swiftness. In body she was of the breed of those birds and beasts that are at once long and alert, like greyhounds or herons, or even like an innocent snake. The whole house revolved on her as on a rod of steel. It would be wrong to say that she commanded, for her own efficiency was so impatient that she obeyed herself before anyone else obeyed her. Before electricians could mend a bell or locksmiths open a door, before dentists could pluck a tooth or butlers draw a tight cork, it was done already with the silent violence of her slim hands. She was light, but there was nothing leaping about her lightness. She spurned the ground, and she meant to spurn it. People talk of the pathos and failure of plain women, but it is a more terrible thing that a beautiful woman may succeed in everything but womanhood. "It is enough to blow your head off," said the young woman in white, going to the looking-glass. The young woman in blue made no reply, and put away her gardening gloves, and then went to the sideboard and began to spread out an afternoon cloth for tea. "Enough to blow your head off, I say," said Miss Rosamund Hunt, with the unruffled cheeriness of one whose songs and speeches had always been safe for an encore. "Only your hat, I think," said Diana Duke, "but I dare say that is sometimes more important." Rosamund's face showed for an instant the offense of a spoiled child, and then the humor of a very healthy person. She broke into a laugh and said, "Well, it would have to be a big wind to blow your head off." There was another silence, and the sunset, breaking more and more from the sundering clouds, filled the room with soft fire and painted the dull walls with ruby and gold. "Somebody once told me," said Rosamund Hunt, "that it's easier to keep one's head when one has lost one's heart."
"Oh, don't talk such rubbish," said Diana, with savage sharpness.
Outside, the garden was clad in a golden splendour, but the wind was still stiffly blowing, and the three men who stood their ground might also have considered the problem of hats and heads. And indeed their position, touching hats, was somewhat typical of them. The tallest of the three abode the blast in a high silk hat, which the wind seemed to charge as vainly as that other sullen tower, the house behind him. The second man tried to hold on a stiff straw hat at all angles, and ultimately held it in his hand. The third had no hat, and by his attitude seemed never to have had one in his life. Perhaps this wind was a kind of fairy wand to test men and women, for there was much of the three men in this difference. The man in the solid silk hat was the embodiedness of silkiness and solidity. He was a big, bland, bored, and, as some said, boring man, with flat, fair hair and handsome, heavy features, a prosperous young doctor by the name of Warner. But if his blondness and blandness seemed at first a little fatuous, it is certain that he was no fool. If Rosamund Hunt was the only person there with much money, he was the only person who had as yet found any kind of fame. His treatise on the probable existence of pain in the lowest organisms had been universally hailed by the scientific world as at once solid and daring. In short, he undoubtedly had brains, and perhaps it was not his fault if they were the kind of brains that most men desire to analyze with a poker. The young man who put his hat off and on was a scientific amateur in a small way, and worshipped the great Warner with a solemn freshness. It was, in fact, at his invitation that the distinguished doctor was present, for Warner lived in no such ramshackle lodging-house, but in a professional palace in Harley Street. This young man was really the youngest and best-looking of the three, but he was one of those persons, both male and female, who seemed doomed to be good-looking and insignificant. Brown-haired, high-coloured, and shy, he seemed to lose the delicacy of his features in a sort of blur of brown and red as he stood blushing and blinking against the wind. He was one of those obvious, unnoticeable people. Everyone knew that he was Arthur Inglewood, unmarried, moral, decidedly intelligent, living on little money of his own, and hiding himself in the two hobbies of photography and cycling. Everybody knew him and forgot him. Even as he stood there in the glare of the golden sunset, there was something about him indistinct, like one of his own red-brown amateur photographs. The third man had no hat. He was lean, in light, vaguely sporting clothes, and the large pipe in his mouth made him look all the leaner. He had a long, ironical face, blue-black hair, the eyes of an Irishman, and the blue chin of an actor. An Irishman he was. An actor he was not, except in the olden days of Miss Hunt's charades, being, as a matter of fact, an obscure and flippant journalist named Michael Moon. He had once been hazily supposed to be reading for the bar, but, as Warner would say with his rather elephantine wit, it was mostly at another kind of bar that his friends found him. Moon, however, did not drink, nor even frequently get drunk. He simply was a gentleman who liked low company. This was partly because company is quieter than society, and if he enjoyed talking to a barmaid, as apparently he did, it was chiefly because the barmaid did the talking. Moreover, he would often bring other talent to assist her. He shared that strange trick of all men of his type, intellectual and without ambition, the trick of going about with his mental inferiors. There was a small, resilient Jew named Moses Gould in the same boarding-house, a man whose negro vitality and vulgarity amused Michael so much that he went round with him from bar to bar like the owner of a performing monkey. The colossal clearance which the wind had made of that cloudy sky grew clearer and clearer. Chamber within chamber seemed to open in heaven.
One felt one might at last find something lighter than light. In the fullness of the silent effulgence all things collected their colours again. The grey trunks turned silver and the drab gravel gold. One bird fluttered like a loosened leaf from one tree to another, and his brown feathers were brushed with fire. "Inglewood," said Michael Moon, with his blue eyes on the bird, "have you any friends?" Dr. Warner mistook the person addressed, and turning a broad, beaming face, said, "Oh, yes, I go out a great deal." Michael Moon gave a tragic grin and waited for his real informant, who spoke a moment after in a voice curiously cool, fresh, and young, as coming out of that brown and even dusty interior. "Really," answered Inglewood, "I am afraid I've lost touch with my old friends. The greatest friend I ever had was at school, a fellow named Smith. It's odd you should mention it, because I was thinking of him today, though I haven't seen him for 7 or 8 years. He was on the science side with me at school, a clever fellow, though queer, and he often went up to Oxford when I went to Germany. The fact is, it's rather a sad story. I often asked him to come and see me, and when I heard nothing I made inquiries, you know. I was shocked to learn that poor Smith had gone off his head. The accounts were a bit cloudy, of course, some saying that he had recovered again, but they always say that. About a year ago I got a telegram from him myself. The telegram, I am sorry to say, put the matter beyond a doubt." End of section 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 2, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 1, How the Great Wind Came to Beacon House. Part 2. "Quite so," assented Dr. Warner stolidly. "Insanity is generally incurable." "So is sanity," said the Irishman, and studied him with a dreary eye. "Symptoms?" asked the doctor. "What was this telegram?" "It's a shame to joke about such things," said Inglewood, in his honest, embarrassed way. "The telegram was Smith's illness, not Smith. The actual words were, 'Man found alive with two legs.'" "Alive with two legs," repeated Michael, frowning. "Perhaps a version of alive and kicking? I don't know much about people out of their senses, but I suppose they ought to be kicking." "And people in their senses?" asked Dr. Warner, smiling. "Oh, they ought to be kicked," said Michael with a sudden heartiness. "The message is clearly insane," continued the impenetrable Warner. "The best test is a reference to the undeveloped normal type. Even a baby does not expect to find a man with three legs." "Three legs," said Michael Moon, "would be very convenient in this wind." A fresh eruption of the atmosphere had indeed almost thrown them off their balance and broken the blackened trees in the garden beyond. All sorts of accidental objects could be seen scouring the wind-scoured sky: straws, sticks, rags, papers, and, in the distance, a disappearing hat. Its disappearance, however, was not final. After an interval of minutes they saw it again, much larger and closer, like a white Panama towering up into the heavens, like a balloon staggering to and fro for an instant, like a stricken kite, and then settling in the centre of their own lawn as falteringly as a dead leaf. "Somebody's lost a good hat," said Dr. Warner shortly. Almost as he spoke, another object came over the garden wall, flying after the fluttering Panama. It was a big green umbrella. After that came hurtling a huge yellow Gladstone bag, and after that a figure like a flying wheel of legs, as in the shield of the Isle of Man. But though for a flash it seemed to have 5 or 6 legs, it alighted upon 2, like the man in the queer telegram. It took the form of a large, light-haired man in gay green holiday clothes. He had bright blonde hair, and the wind brushed back like a German's a flushed, eager face like a cherub's, and a prominent, pointing nose, a little like a dog's. His head, however, was by no means cherubic in the sense of being without a body. On the contrary, on his vast shoulders and shape generally gigantesque, his head looked oddly and unnaturally small. This gave rise to a scientific theory which his conduct fully supported, that he was an idiot. Inglewood had a politeness, instinctive and yet awkward. His life was full of arrested half-gestures of assistance, and even this prodigy of a big man in green, leaping the wall like a bright green grasshopper, did not paralyze that small altruism of his habits in such a matter as a lost hat. He was stepping forward to recover the green gentleman's headgear, when he was struck rigid with a roar like a bull's. "Unsportsmanlike!" bellowed the big man. "Give it fair play! Give it fair play!" And he came after his own hat quickly, but cautiously, with burning eyes. The hat had seemed at first to droop and dawdle, as in ostentatious languor on the sunny lawn. But the wind again freshened, and rising, it went dancing down the garden with the devilry of a pas de quatre. The eccentric went bounding after it, with kangaroo leaps and bursts of breathless speech, of which it was not always easy to pick up the thread. "Fair play, fair play! Sportive kings chase their crowns, quite humane. Tramontana, cardinals chase red hats, old English hunting, started a hat in Brambercombe, hat at bay, mangled hounds, got him." As the wind rose out of a roar into a shriek, he leapt into the sky on his strong, fantastic legs, snatched at the vanishing hat, missed it, and pitched sprawling, face foremost, on the grass. The hat rose over him like a bird in triumph, but its triumph was premature, for the lunatic, flung upward on his hands, threw up his boots behind, waved his two legs in the air like symbolic ensigns, so that they actually thought again of the telegram, and actually caught the hat with his feet. A prolonged and piercing yell of wind split the welkin from end to end. The eyes of all the men were blinded by the invisible blast as by a strange, clear cataract of transparency rushing between them and all objects about them. But as the large man fell back in a sitting position and solemnly crowned himself with the hat, Michael found, to his incredulous surprise, that he had been holding his breath like a man watching a duel. While that tall wind was at the top of its sky-scraping energy, another short cry was heard, beginning very querulous, but ending very quick, swallowed in abrupt silence. The shiny black cylinder of Dr. Warner's official hat sailed off his head in the long, smooth parabola of an airship, and in almost cresting a garden tree was caught in the topmost branches. Another hat was gone. Those in that garden felt themselves caught in an unaccustomed eddy of things happening. No one seemed to know what would blow away next. Before they could speculate, the cheering and hallooing hat-hunter was already halfway up the tree, swinging himself from fork to fork with his strong, bent grasshopper legs, and still giving forth his gasping, mysterious comments. "Tree of life, Yggdrasil, climb for centuries, perhaps. Owls nesting in the hat, remotest generation of owls, still usurpers. Gone to heaven, man in the moon wears it. Brigand, not yours. Belongs to depressed medical man in garden. Give it up, give it up." The tree swung and swept and thrashed to and fro in the thundering wind like a thistle, and flamed in the full sunshine like a bonfire. The green, fantastic human figure, vivid against its autumn red and gold, was already among its highest and craziest branches, which by bare luck did not break with the weight of his big body. He was up there among the last tossing leaves and the first twinkling stars of evening. Still talking to himself cheerfully, reasoningly, half-apologetically, in little gasps, he might well be out of breath, for his whole preposterous raid had gone with one rush. He had bounded the wall once like a football, swept down the garden like a slide, and shot up the tree like a rocket. The other three men seemed buried under incident piled on incident, a wild world where one thing began before another thing left off. All three had the first thought. The tree had been there for the 5 years they had known the boarding-house. Each one of them was active and strong. No one of them had even thought of climbing it. Beyond that, Inglewood felt first the mere fact of colour. The bright, brisk leaves, the bleak blue sky, the wild green arms and legs reminded him irrationally of something glowing in his infancy, something akin to a gaudy man on a golden tree. Perhaps it was only a painted monkey on a stick. Oddly enough, Michael Moon, though more of a humorist, was touched on a tenderer nerve. Half remembered the old young theatricals with Rosamond, and was amused to find himself almost quoting Shakespeare. For valour, is not love Hercules still climbing trees in the Hesperides? Even the immovable man of science had a bright, bewildered sensation that the time machine had given a great jerk and gone forward with a rather rattling rapidity. He was not, however, wholly prepared for what happened next. The man in green, riding the frail topmost bough like a witch on a very risky broomstick, reached up and rent the black hat from its airy nest of twigs. It had been broken across a heavy bough in the first burst of its passage. A tangle of branches had torn and scored and scratched it in every direction. A clap of wind and foliage had flattened it like a concertina. Nor can it be said that the obliging gentleman with the sharp nose showed any adequate tenderness for its structure when he finally unhooked it from its place. When he had found it, however, his proceedings were by some counted singular. He waved it with a loud whoop of triumph, and then immediately appeared to fall backwards off the tree, to which, however, he remained attached by his long, strong legs like a monkey swung by his tail. Hanging thus head downward above the unhelmeted Warner, he gravely proceeded to drop the battered silk cylinder upon his brows. "Every man a king," explained the inverted philosopher. "Every hat, consequently, a crown. But this is a crown of heaven." And he again attempted the coronation of Warner, who, however, moved away with great abruptness from the hovering diadem, not seeming, strangely enough, to wish for his former decoration in its present state. "Wrong, wrong," cried the obliging person hilariously. "Always wear a uniform, even if it's a shabby uniform. Ritualist may always be untidy. Go to a dance with soot on your shirt front, but go with a shirt front. Huntsman wears old coat, but old pink coat. Wear a topper, even if it's got no top. It's the symbol that counts, old cock. Take your hat, because it is your hat after all. It's nap rubbed all off by the bark, dears, and its brim not the least bit curled, but for old sake's sake, it is still, dears, the knobbiest tile in the world." Speaking thus with wild comfortableness, he settled or smashed the shapeless silk hat over the face of the disturbed physician, and fell on his feet among the other men, still talking, beaming, and breathless. "Why don't they make more games out of the wind?" he asked in some excitement. "Kites are all right, but why should it only be kites? Why, I thought of three other games for a windy day while I was climbing that tree. Here's one of them. You take a lot of pepper." "I think," interposed Moon with sardonic mildness, "that your games are already sufficiently interesting. Are you, may I ask, a professional acrobat on tour, or a travelling advertisement of Sunny Jim? How and why do you display all this energy for clearing walls and climbing trees in our melancholy but at least rational suburbs?" The stranger, so far as so loud a person was capable of it, appeared to grow confidential. "Well, it's a trick of my own," he confessed candidly. "I do it by having two legs." Arthur Inglewood, who had shrunk into the background of this scene of folly, started and stared at the newcomer with his short-sighted eyes screwed up and his high colour slightly heightened. "Why, I believe you're Smith," he cried with his fresh, almost boyish voice, and then, after an instant's stare, "and yet I'm not sure." "I have a card, I think," said the unknown with a baffling solemnity, "a card with my real name, my titles, offices, and true purpose on this earth." He drew out slowly from an upper waistcoat pocket a scarlet card case, and as slowly produced a very large card. Even in the instant of its production they fancied it was of a queer shape, unlike the card of ordinary gentlemen. But it was there only for an instant, for as it passed from his fingers to Arthur's, one or another slipped his hold. The strident, tearing gale in that garden carried away the stranger's card to join the wild waste-paper of the universe, and that great western wind shook the whole house and passed. End of chapter 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 3, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 2, The Luggage of an Optimist. Part 1. We all remember the fairy tales of science in our infancy, which played with the supposition that large animals could jump in proportion of small ones. If an elephant were as strong as a grasshopper, he could, I suppose, spring clean out of the zoological gardens and alight trumpeting upon Primrose Hill. If a whale could leap from the sea like a trout, perhaps men might look up and see one soaring above Yarmouth like the winged island of Laputa. Such natural energy, though sublime, might certainly be inconvenient, and much of this inconvenience attended the gaiety and good intentions of the man in green. Because he was lively as well as large, by a fortunate physical provision, most very substantial creatures are also reposeful, and middle-class boarding-houses in the lesser parts of London are not built for a man as big as a bull and as excitable as a kitten. When Inglewood followed the stranger into the boarding-house, he found him talking earnestly, and in his own opinion privately, to the helpless Mrs. Duke. That fat, faint lady could only goggle up like a dying fish at the enormous new gentleman who politely offered himself as a lodger, with vast gestures of the wide white hat in one hand and the yellow Gladstone bag in the other. Fortunately, Mrs. Duke's more efficient niece and partner was there to complete the contrast, for, indeed, all the people of the house had somehow collected in the room. This fact, in truth, was typical of the whole episode. The visitor created an atmosphere of comic crisis, and from the time he came into the house to the time he left it, he somehow got the company to gather and even follow, though in derision, as children gather and follow a Punch and Judy. An hour ago, and for 4 years previously, these people had avoided each other even when they had really liked each other. They had slid in and out of dismal and deserted rooms in search of particular newspapers or private needlework. Even now they all came casually, as with varying interests, but they all came. There was the embarrassed Inglewood, still a sort of red shadow. There was the unembarrassed Warner, a pallid but solid substance. There was Michael Moon, offering, like a riddle, the contrast of the horsey crudeness of his clothes and the somber sagacity of his visage. He was now joined by his yet more comic crony, Moses Gould. Swaggering on short legs with prosperous purple tie, he was the gayest of godless little dogs, but, like a dog also in this, that however he danced and wagged with delight, the two dark eyes on each side of his protuberant nose glistened gloomily like black buttons. There was Miss Rosamond Hunt, still with the fine white hat framing her square good-looking face, and still with her native air of being dressed for some party that never came off. She, also, like Mr. Moon, had a new companion, new so far as this narrative goes, but in reality an old friend and a protégé. This was a slight young woman in dark gray, and in no way notable but for a load of dull red hair, of which the shape somehow gave her pale face that triangular, almost peaked appearance which was given by the lowering headdress and deep, rich ruff of the Elizabethan beauties. Her surname seemed to be Gray, and Miss Hunt called her Mary, in that indescribable tone applied to a dependent who has practically become a friend. She wore a small silver cross on her very businesslike grey clothes, and was the only member of the party who went to church. Last, but the reverse of least, there was Diana Duke, studying the newcomer with eyes of steel and listening carefully to every idiotic word he said. As for Mrs. Duke, she smiled up at him, but never dreamed of listening to him. She had never really listened to anyone in her life, which some said was why she had survived. Nevertheless, Mrs. Duke was pleased with her new guest's concentration of courtesy upon herself, for no one ever spoke seriously to her any more than she listened seriously to any one. And she almost beamed as the stranger, with yet wider and far almost whirling gestures of explanation, with his huge hat and bag, apologized for having entered by the wall instead of the front door. He was understood to put it down to an unfortunate family tradition of neatness and care of his clothes. "My mother was rather strict about it, to tell the truth," he said, lowering his voice to Mrs. Duke. "She never liked me to lose my cap at school. And when a man's been taught to be tidy and neat, it sticks to him." Mrs. Duke weakly gasped that she was sure he must have had a good mother, but her niece seemed inclined to probe the matter further. "You've got a funny idea of neatness," she said, "if it's of jumping garden walls and clambering up garden trees. A man can't very well climb a tree tidily." "He can clear a wall neatly," said Michael Moon. "I saw him do it." Smith seemed to be regarding the girl with genuine astonishment. "My dear young lady," he said, "I was tidying the tree. You don't want last year's hats there, do you? Any more than last year's leaves? The wind takes off the leaves, but it couldn't manage the hat. That wind, I suppose, has tidied the whole forest today. Rum idea, this is, that tidiness is a timid, quiet sort of thing. Why, tidiness is a toil for giants. You can't tidy up anything without untidying yourself. Just look at my trousers. Don't you know that? Haven't you ever had a spring cleaning?" "Oh, yes, sir," said Mrs. Duke, almost eagerly. "You'll find everything of that sort quite nice." For the first time, she had heard two words that she could understand. Miss Diana Duke seemed to be studying the stranger with a sort of spasm of calculation. Then her black eyes snapped with decision, and she said that he could have a particular bedroom on the top floor if he liked. And the silent and sensitive Inglewood, who had been on the rack through these cross purposes, eagerly offered to show him up to the room. Smith went up to the stairs four at a time, and when he bumped his head against the ultimate ceiling, Inglewood had an odd sensation that the tall house was much shorter than it used to be. Arthur Inglewood followed his old friend, or his new friend, for he did not very clearly know which he was. The face looked very like his old schoolfellow at one second, and very unlike at another. And when Inglewood broke through the native politeness so far as to say suddenly, "Is your name Smith?" he received only the unenlightening reply, "Quite right, quite right, very good, excellent," which appeared to Inglewood, on reflection, rather the speech of a newborn babe accepting a name than of a grown-up man admitting one. Despite these doubts about identity, the hapless Inglewood watched the other unpack, and soon about his bedroom, in all the important attitudes of the male friend, Mr. Smith unpacked with the same kind of whirling accuracy with which he climbed a tree, throwing things out of his bag as if they were rubbish, yet managing to distribute quite a regular pattern all round him on the floor. As he did so, he continued to talk in the same, somewhat gasping manner. He had come upstairs four steps at a time, but even without this, his style of speech was breathless and fragmentary, and his remarks were still a string of more or less significant, but often separate pictures. "Like the Day of Judgment," he said, throwing a bottle so that it somehow settled rocking on its right end. "People say vast universe, infinity, and astronomy. Not sure. I think things are too close together. Packed up for traveling. Stars too close, really. Why, the sun's a star, too close to be seen properly. The earth's a star, too close to be seen at all. Too many pebbles on the beach. Ought all to be put in rings. Too many blades of grass to study.
Feathers on a bird make the brain reel. Wait till the big bag is unpacked. May all be put in our right places then. Here he stopped literally for breath, throwing a shirt to the other end of the room and then a bottle of ink so that it fell quite neatly beyond it. Inglewood looked round on this strange, half-symmetrical disorder with increasing doubt. In fact, the more one explored Mr. Smith's holiday luggage, the less one could make anything of it. One peculiarity of it was that almost everything seemed to be there for the wrong reason. What is secondary with everyone else was primary with him. He would wrap up a pot or a pan in brown paper, and the unthinking assistant would discover that the pot was valueless or even unnecessary, and that it was the brown paper that was truly precious. He produced two or three boxes of cigars and explained with plain and perplexing sincerity that he was no smoker, but that cigar box wood was by far the best for fretwork. He also exhibited about six small bottles of wine, white and red, and Inglewood, happening to note a Volnay which he knew to be excellent, supposed at first that the stranger was an epicure in vintages. He was therefore surprised to find that the next bottle was a vile sham claret from the colonies, which even colonials, to do them justice, do not drink. It was only then that he observed that all six bottles had those bright metallic seals of various tints, and seemed to have been chosen solely because they have the three primary and three secondary colors, red, blue, and yellow, green, violet, and orange. There grew upon Inglewood an almost creepy sense of the real childishness of this creature, for Smith was really, so far as human psychology can be, innocent. He had the sensualities of innocent. He loved the stickiness of gum, and he cut white wood greedily as if he were cutting a cake. To this man, wine was not a doubtful thing to be defended or denounced. It was a quaintly colored syrup, such as a child sees in a shop window. He talked dominantly and rushed the social situation, but he was not asserting himself like a Superman in a modern play. He was simply forgetting himself like a little boy at a party. He had somehow made the giant stride from babyhood to manhood, and missed that crisis in youth when most of us grow old. As he shunted his big bag, Arthur observed the initials I.S. printed on one side of it, and remembered that Smith had been called Innocent Smith at school. Though whether as a formal Christian name or a moral description, he could not remember. He was just about to venture another question when there was a knock at the door, and the short figure of Mr. Gould offered itself, with the melancholy moon standing like his tall, crooked shadow behind him. They had drifted up the stairs after the other two men with the wandering gregariousness of the male. "Hope there's no intrusion," said the beaming Moses, with a glow of good nature, but not the airiest tinge of apology. "The truth is," said Michael Moon, with a comparative courtesy, "we thought we might see if they had made you comfortable. Miss Duke is rather..." "I know," cried the stranger, looking up radiantly from his bag. "Magnificent, isn't she? Go close to her, hear military music going by like Joan of Arc." Inglewood stared and stared at the speaker like one who has just heard a wild fairy tale, which nevertheless contains one small and forgotten fact. For he remembered how he himself had thought of Joan of Arc years ago, when hardly more than a schoolboy he had first come to the boarding house. Long since the pulverizing rationalism of his friend Dr. Warner had crushed such youthful ignorances and disproportionate dreams, under the Warnerian skepticism and science of hopeless human types, Inglewood had long come to regard himself as a timid, insufficient, and weak type who would never marry, to regard Diana Duke as a materialistic maidservant, and to regard his first fancy for her as the small, dull farce of a collegian kissing his landlady's daughter. And yet the phrase about military music moved him queerly, as if he had heard those distant drums. End of part one.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit
LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G. K. Chesterton. Section 4, Part 1, The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 2, The Language of an Optimist, Part 2. "She has to keep things pretty tight, as is only natural," said Moon, glancing round the rather dwarfish room with its wedge of slanted ceiling like the conical hood of a dwarf. "Rather a small box for you," said the waggish Mr. Gould. "Splendid room, though," answered Mr. Smith enthusiastically, with his head inside his Gladstone bag. "I love these pointed sort of rooms, like Gothic. By the way," he cried out, pointing in a quite startling way, "where does that door lead to?" "To certain death, I should say," answered Michael Moon, staring up at a dust-stained and disused trap-door in the sloping roof of the attic. "I don't think there's a loft there, and I don't know what else it could lead to." Long before he had finished his sentence, the man with the strong green legs had leapt at the door in the ceiling, swung himself somehow onto the ledge beneath it, wrenched it open after a struggle, and clambered through it. For a moment they saw the two symbolic legs standing like a truncated statue, then they vanished. Through the hole thus burst in the roof appeared the empty and lucid sky of the evening, with one great many-colored cloud sailing across it like a whole country upside down. "Hello, you fellows!" came the far cry of Innocent Smith, apparently from some remote pinnacle. "Come up here and bring some of my things to eat and drink. It's just the spot for a picnic." With a sudden impulse, Michael snatched two of the small bottles of wine, one in each solid fist, and Arthur Inglewood, as if mesmerized, groped for a biscuit tin and a big jar of ginger. The enormous hand of Innocent Smith, appearing through the aperture like a giant in a fairy tale, received these tributes and bore them off to the eyrie. Then they both hoisted themselves out of the window. They were both athletic and even gymnastic. Inglewood, through his concern for hygiene, and Moon, through his concern for sport, which was not quite so idle and inactive as that of the average sportsman. Also, they both had a light-headed burst of celestial sensation when the door was burst in the roof, as if a door had been burst in the sky, and they could climb out onto the very roof of the universe. They were both men who had long been unconsciously imprisoned in the commonplace, though one took it in comically and the other seriously. They were both men, nevertheless, in whom sentiment had never died. But Mr. Moses Gould had an equal contempt for their suicidal athletics and their subconscious transcendentalism, and he stood and laughed at the thing with the shameless rationality of another race. When the singular Smith, astride of a chimney-pot, learnt that Gould was not following, his infantile officiousness and good nature forced him to dive back into the attic to comfort or persuade, and Inglewood and Moon were left alone on the long grey-green ridge of the slate roof, with their feet against gutters and their backs against chimney-pots, looking agnostically at each other. Their first feeling was that they had come out into eternity, and that eternity was very like topsy-turvydom. One definition occurred to both of them, that he had come out into the light of that lucid and radiant ignorance in which all beliefs had begun. The sky above them was full of mythology. Heaven seemed deep enough to hold all the gods. The round of the ether turned from green to yellow gradually, like a great unripe fruit. All round the sunken sun it was like a lemon. Round all the east it was a sort of golden green, more suggestive of a greengage. But the whole had still the emptiness of daylight, and none of the secrecy of dusk. Tumbled here and there across his gold and pale green were shards and shattered masses of inky purple cloud, which seemed falling toward the earth in every kind of colossal perspective. One of them really had the character of some many-mitred, many-bearded, many-winged Assyrian image, huge head downwards, hurled out of heaven, a sort of false Jehovah, who was perhaps Satan. All the other clouds had preposterous, pinnacled shapes, as if the gods' palaces had been flung after him. And yet, while the empty heaven was full of silent catastrophe, the height of human buildings above which they sat held here and there a tiny trivial noise that was the exact antithesis, and they heard some 6 streets below a newsboy calling and a bell bidding to chapel. They could also hear talk out of the garden below, and realize that the irrepressible Smith must have followed Gould downstairs, for his eager and pleading accents could be heard, followed by the half-humorous protests of Miss Duke and the full and very youthful laughter of Rosamond Hunt. The air had that cold kindness that comes after a storm. Michael Moon drank it in with as serious a relish as he had drunk the little bottle of cheap claret, which he had emptied almost at a draught. Inglewood went on eating ginger very slowly and with a solemnity unfathomable as the sky above him. There was still stir in the freshness of the atmosphere to make them almost fancy they could smell the garden soil and the last roses of autumn. Suddenly there came from the darkening room a silvery ping and pong which told them that Rosamond had brought out the long-neglected mandolin. After the first few notes there was more of the distant bell-like laughter. "Inglewood," said Michael Moon, "have you ever heard that I am a blackguard?"
"I haven't heard it, and I don't believe it," answered Inglewood, after an odd pause. "But I have heard you were what they call rather wild."
"If you have heard that I am wild, you can contradict the rumour," said Moon, with an extraordinary calm. "I am tame. I am quite tame. I am about the tamest beast that crawls. I drink too much of the same kind of whiskey at the same time every night. I even drink about the same amount too much. I go to the same number of public houses. I meet the same darned women with mauve faces. I hear the same number of dirty stories, generally the same dirty stories. You may assure my friends, Inglewood, that you see before you a person whom civilization has thoroughly tamed." Arthur Inglewood was staring with feelings that made him nearly fall off the roof, for indeed the Irishman's face, always sinister, was now almost demoniacal. "Christ confound it!" cried out Moon, suddenly clutching the empty claret bottle. "This is about the thinnest and filthiest wine I ever uncorked, and it's the only drink I have really enjoyed for 9 years. I was never wild till 10 minutes ago." And he sent the bottle whizzing, a wheel of glass, far away beyond the garden, into the road, where in the profound evening silence they could even hear it break and part upon the stones. "Moon," said Arthur Inglewood rather huskily, "you mustn't be so bitter about it. Everyone has to take the world as he finds it. Of course, one often finds it a bit dull."
"That fellow doesn't," said Michael decisively. "I mean that fellow Smith. I have a sort of fancy there's some method in his madness. It looks as if he could turn into a sort of wonderland at any minute by taking one step out on the plain road. Who would have thought of that trap door? Who would have thought that this cursed colonial claret could taste quite nice among the chimney-pots? Perhaps that's the real key of fairyland. Perhaps Nosey Gould's beastly little empire cigarettes ought only to be smoked on stilts, or something of that sort. Perhaps Mrs. Duke's cold leg of mutton would seem quite appetizing at the top of a tree. Perhaps even my damned dirty, monotonous drizzle of Old Bill whiskey." "Don't be so rough on yourself," said Inglewood in serious distress. "The dullness isn't your fault, or the whiskey's. Fellows who don't, fellows like me, I mean, have just that same feeling that it's all rather flat and a failure. But the world's made like that. It's all survival. Some people are made to get on, like Warner, and some people are made to stick quiet, like me. You can't help your temperament. I know you're much cleverer than I am, but you can't help having all those loose ways of a poor literary chap, and I can't help having all the doubts and helplessness of a small scientific chap, any more than a fish can help floating, or a fern can help curling up. Humanity, as Warner said so well in that lecture, really consists of quite different tribes of animals,
all disguised as men. In the dim garden below, the buzz of talk was suddenly broken by Miss Hunt's musical instrument banging with the abruptness of artillery into a vulgar but spirited tune. Rosamond's voice came up rich and strong in the words of some fatuous, fashionable black song. "Blacks sing a song on the old plantation, sing it as we sang it in the days long gone by." Inglewood's brown eyes softened and saddened still more as he continued his monologue of resignation to such a rollicking and romantic tune. But the blue eyes of Michael Moon brightened and hardened with a light that Inglewood could not understand. Many centuries and many villages and valleys would have been happier if Inglewood or Inglewood's countrymen had ever understood that light, or guessed at the first blink that it was the battle star of Ireland. "Nothing can ever alter it. It's in the wheels of the universe," went on Inglewood in a low voice. "Some men are weak and some strong, and the only thing we can do is to know that we are weak. I have been in love lots of times, but I could not do anything, for I remembered my own fickleness. I have formed opinions, but I haven't the cheek to push them because I've so often changed them. That's the upshot, old fellow. We can't trust ourselves, and we can't help it." Michael had risen to his feet and stood poised in a perilous position at the end of the roof, like some dark statue hung above the gable. Behind him, huge clouds of an almost impossible purple turned slowly topsy-turvy in the silent anarchy of heaven. Their gyration made the dark figure seem yet dizzier. "Let us," he said, and was suddenly silent. "Let us what?" asked Arthur Inglewood, rising equally quick, though somewhat more cautiously, for his friend seemed to find some difficulty in speech. "Let us go and do some of those things we can't do," said Michael. At the same moment there burst out of the trap-door below them the cockatoo hair and flushed face of Innocent Smith, calling to them that they must come down, as the concert was in full swing, and Mr. Moses Gould was about to recite Young Lochinvar. As they dropped into Innocent's attic, they nearly tumbled over its entertaining impedimenta again. Inglewood, staring at the littered floor, thought instinctively of the littered floor of a nursery. He was therefore the more moved and even shocked when his eye fell on a large, well-polished American revolver. "Hello!" he cried, stepping back from the steely glitter as men step back from a serpent. "Are you afraid of burglars, or when and why do you deal death out of that machine gun?" "Oh, that," said Smith, throwing his single glance, "I deal life out of that." And he went bounding down the stairs. End of chapter 2.